This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick on Twitter at OldFLA and visit his website, rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to this week's edition of the Florida Spectacular. Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. It's a sunny day in Orlando, and you're not at home this week, right?
I am not at home this week. I am in Ocala right now. I gave a talk at something called Master the Possibilities by On Top of the World. And I'm giving another one this afternoon, but my first talk was about the Seminole Tribe of Florida, and I got to talk about one of my favorite Florida fallacies. And that is, of course, that the Seminole Tribe is a new tribe, only having arrived here in the 1700s, which is patently false. So with that, why don't we talk about our favorite things that people get wrong about Florida, our myths?
Yeah.
You must have one.
Well, I'm intrigued by what you're talking about right off the bat. So tell me more. What I've always heard is that the Seminole Tribe is made up of Creeks and other tribes that came down from Georgia and South Carolina. And they just were given the name Seminole, which kind of means runaway in Spanish, or is derived from the word that means runaway in Spanish. Tell me if I'm wrong in that perception.
You are wrong in that perception. And let me tell you why. This is one of my favorite stories to tell. My one day forthcoming book, The Florida Spectacular, initially had a chapter, about the Seminole Tribe of Florida in it. And I since been winnowed down. It is simply about one exquisite woman in the Seminole Tribe. But at first, the first steps in doing anything when you're writing a nonfiction book is research. So I made an appointment to go down to something called TIPO, which is the Tribal Historic Preservation Office. And I met with the head of TIPO, Paul Backhouse. And I asked him, I said, so all these tribes in Florida, because I too received that education that they were a new tribe comprised of runaway slaves. There were no Indians in Florida until they showed up here. And I asked him, I said, so what is the relationship between the Seminole today and the Colusa and the Apalachee and all the Indians that were in Florida before the Seminole? And he just looked at me, but he's a delightful guy, British. And he looked at me and he just kind of shook his head. He goes, those words mean nothing to the tribe. Those are all just words that Europeans gave them. And that was a big, hard thing for me to swallow right there. And I said, well, but I thought the Seminole were new. And he's like, no, the Seminole are here. They've always been here. And they're going to, they can prove it. Basically, they have oral histories that they have told for hundreds, if not longer, of years. And no, that narrative got kind of invented when it became clear that we were having a little bit of a hard time as Euro-Americans in taking the land away from the Seminole. No, they've always been here. And for some reason, the federal government and the state seem really invested in not giving the tribe ownership. In fact, they've actually forced the Smithsonian Institution into changing their policies about repatriation of artifacts. They, because it was the stance of our government that the Seminole Tribe of Florida was new, any remains at the Smithsonian that predated whatever arbitrary date we said it was just runaway slaves coming here, they wouldn't give to the tribe. They were holding them. They would not return the artifacts. They wouldn't return the remains. They wouldn't, nothing. And so the Seminole Tribe of Florida started a campaign, No More Stolen Ancestors. And their museum in South Florida pulled its affiliation from the Smithsonian and made a public showing as to why. And within, I think, 2 years, the Seminole Tribe of Florida had convinced the Smithsonian to change its policy on repatriation of artifacts to the tribe, which is a pretty cool thing.
Because, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you can, if they're not a real people, if they're just made up of other people. And in fact, I get this wrong in my first book. I say that in my first book and nobody corrected me, but I didn't have anybody at the tribe look at it because it was just a very offhanded remark I made. And I regret it, but yeah, it's fake. They've been here. I mean, so, and think about it, doesn't it make sense that if you were going to come to the United States, wouldn't you want to go to Florida anyway? How could Florida just be uninhabited? No, absolutely.
But my understanding is that, you know, those people that, you know, we have named the Colusa, the Tamuqua, the Apalachee, the, you know, those people, that most of them were wiped out because, one, you know, the people of European descent, you know, had a hand in wiping them out, and that they had no resistance to disease. And that, you know, for instance, in St. Augustine, you know, a lot of the descendants of those people who were left went down to Spain when British took over Spanish Florida in the late 1700s. Is that, you're saying that's not accurate?
I am saying that we wiped out many, many, many of Florida's first people, but not all of them. And those are the ancestors of the Seminole tribe of Florida. And yes, of course, certainly people did come from southern states. We know, you know, keep in mind, Florida is an arbitrary line we've drawn on a map because Florida used to go all the way to the Mississippi River.
Okay.
And it was a little farther north than it was today. But yeah, of course, we've had other, when Florida was under Spanish control, we absolutely had people from other tribes come down here because Spain wasn't quite as murdery, rapey, killy. So yeah, I mean, it was a source of great consternation when Andrew Jackson started marching into Florida randomly and killing people. But, you know, it was still better than being an Indian in South Carolina.
Would it be accurate to say that the Seminole people, as we call them, are kind of a melting pot of people from all different geographic locations? Is that accurate?
No, that is not accurate. Not to my understanding, because the bulk of the Seminole are descended from people who have lived here.
The bulk
of the Seminole, just like the bulk of any Indian tribe. Florida has more people from other places across the board. So yes, of course, the Seminole tribe of Florida has people. They have people who have probably historically lived in points north, but it's not like a bunch of people came here in the 1700s and we had pretty much wiped out everybody else. It is my understanding from the Seminole tribe of Florida is their oral histories indicate that they were already pretty well peopled by the time Manifest Destiny started causing the other Americans to do horrible things to Indians in other places. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it is different than what I've heard. And there is also a question of languages, because I know, for instance, what I've heard is like Tamuqua, you know, was one language, and that there were people like the people who were down in Central Florida who were not Tamuqua but spoke the Tamuqua language. So what do they say about that? You know, because what my understanding is, what the Seminole speak is a derivation of Creek. Is that correct?
So I want to make two things clear. One, I am not a representative of the tribe. I cannot speak other than anything from what I have learned by speaking with people who work for the tribe, who represent the tribe in the forms of history. I can't speak with authority as to the language because I am not 100% sure.
Yeah.
But I would encourage you to think, first of all, about the difference in dialects and patois and things that we have in white America, as opposed to, and it's certainly not as vast, but just because one person says buggy and I say wagon and you say cart doesn't mean necessarily we have a wholly separate genetic makeup, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
What do you say? Cart, wagon, buggy, what do you say?
What are you referring to?
Yeah, see, hence my issue. If you go into a grocery store, what do you get to put your groceries in?
Oh, a cart. I get a cart.
I say a wagon.
Interesting.
People look at me like I'm crazy. Soda, pop, Coke. I mean, it's there's nuances to everything. And I think the problem is that the narrative that Euro-Americans have put forth about the people in the Seminole tribe of Florida is a black and white narrative. And as Americans, we do great with black and white. We are fantastic when there are clear lines. If we can go absolute one way, we're great. What we don't do well is nuance or moderation. So we want the answers to fit into boxes, and it's a problem. But And that's why it's fun to talk about. It's fun to talk about. People, somebody came up to me after my talk today and said, well, I noticed you showed a picture of their seal and it says, "In God We Trust." How is that possible? And I said, well, being of Seminole descent doesn't mean you don't believe in a higher power. And it's tricky. It's hard. It's okay.
Yeah, it's just not the Judeo-Christian model of spirituality.
It's God. All it says is God.
Yeah.
I use money on it every day that says, "In God We Trust." And I can promise you, I don't have regular chats with Jesus. So,
Reminds me of, you know, all those cowboy movies that I watched when I was a kid, where, you know, the red man was considered a heathen. And, you know, that was kind of justification for wiping them out because they were the heathen hordes.
We don't actually say that word anymore.
The heathen hordes?
No, the R word.
Well, I mean, that's the narrative that you know, that was in those movies. And, you know, it seems like a vestige of that consciousness still existed for this person.
It absolutely still exists for a lot of people. And people have a hard time when you change anything they think to be true.
Yeah. It is very interesting. It really makes me want to go to Akatiki even more. And I need to
go. It's beautiful this time of year.
I know it is the time of year to go too. And spring break is over. I'm going to have to wait till my wife retires, which will be soon. And then we can go because I really don't want to go.
Campground there that has air conditioned cabins. Just remember real beds.
Yeah, I can't wait to go because I'm fascinated by that. And you know what I love about learning about this kind of stuff is there's so much that we are kind of, you know, it's fluid. You know, we're changing the way we think. It doesn't seem to be set in stone, and that's kind of exciting. I imagine it must be frustrating for an archaeologist or a historian because it seems like the solid ground you're standing on must be ripped out from under you all the time. But it is exciting that we are changing the way we think.
Decolonialization, decolonizing history. They actually have a T-shirt. I bought it down at the Atatiki, and it just says Atatiki. Decolonizing narratives since whenever. And I love it. It's okay. It's okay that, you know, history is always, the history you learn is an interpretation of what somebody wrote down. Like, so they say that reporters write the first draft, newspapers basically write the first draft of history and historians interpret it. And I think you're going to talk about a Florida fallacy that actually came about because of a court reporter in Spanish colonial Florida. Are you not?
The court reporter story eludes me, but I am going to talk about the myth of Fountain of Youth and Ponce de Leon. That's not what I've heard. I mean, I don't know exactly what you speak of.
Tell me your story.
So my story is, well, you know, the myth of the Fountain of Youth and Ponce de Leon stumbling through the state looking for these mythical waters that will grant him eternal life is kind of our foundation myth for this state. And I think it works as a metaphor very well. But the reality of Ponce actually searching for the Fountain of Youth is not true. You know, there has been a myth of a Fountain of Youth long before Ponce de Leon ever came up. Long, you can go back to the ancient Greeks. Alexander the Great supposedly had one. You know, you can look at the story of Gilgamesh, and there's kind of a Fountain of Youth in it. There was a legend of this mythic king named Prester John who had a Fountain of Youth. You know, it's an archetype, and it never got glommed onto him until years after he died. And a lot of it was by political rivals who sought to demean his manhood because, you know, the myth goes he was in love with a younger woman, but he was aging fast, and he wasn't successful in the bedroom, so he had to find this Fountain of Youth. And so I think it was Herrera, and there was an account before Herrera that attached it to him. And these were people who were connected to the Diego Columbus side of things. Mm-hmm. Ponce, before he came to Florida, was the governor of Puerto Rico, and they decided the king made a decree that anything discovered by Christopher Columbus would go to his heirs, and all of a sudden Ponce was without a charter or not without a job anymore. He couldn't be governor anymore. It was Diego Columbus's right to govern Puerto Rico. So Ponce got a charter to search for all lands to the northwest. And so that came long after he was dead. And there were these Spanish accounts that were in the archives, and Washington Irving was writing a new book, and he went and discovered these accounts in the Spanish archives, and he wrote his version of Ponce de Leon and the Fountain of Youth. And, you know, the American public lapped it up. They believed it. The same guy who wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Ichabod Crane and Rip Van Winkle and all those stories we know to be false, somehow believed that the Fountain of Youth was true. Now, what is your version of the story?
So my version is very similar. I think your version is probably more accurate. My version was that there was a court reporter, court chronicler, which maybe isn't the same thing, who was a fan of Diego Columbus.
Right.
And he, the governorship, right, of Puerto Rico was right. being called into question. And he wrote basically a satire, like The Onion or something like that, about this stupid guy who was just so stupid that he was tricked into it. And at the time, everybody, just like if you go to The Onion's website, most people realize that is false. It is satire. And at the time, everybody knew it. But, you know, you tell a lie long enough, as we've seen recently,
right.
it becomes the truth. Like, people knew at the time it was a joke. It was making fun of him. It was like a skit on SNL. They would have had, you know, I don't know, Pete Davidson wandering around trying to find a Fountain of Youth and, you know, all that stuff. And people knew and they laughed at it. But, you know, that was the extent of it, that it goes to, you know, it was a court reporter who told it first. But your version sounds far better researched.
Yeah, you know, this whole idea of water having power, you know, the sacredness and the spirituality of water is present in cultures across the globe throughout time. And so it's easy to believe that, you know, it can make you young again. You know how you feel when you jump in a 72 degree spring. You feel rejuvenated. You feel alive. You feel like a kid. You feel like getting out because you're freezing. So it's easy to see how it was attached to us. But, you know, it's so funny because it's been repeated so often by so many people who are credible. You will find it in history books. Henry Louis Gates Jr., who my wife and I love his show on PBS, and he wrote an article and he talked about Ponce de Leon looking for the Fountain of Youth. And it's like, dude, you're one of our favorite scholars. How could you repeat it? And it gets repeated again and again. And the other thing that drives me crazy is sometimes I'll do posts on social media and people go, it's insane. Augustine. The Fountain of Youth is in St. Augustine. It's like, yes, there is an attraction called the Fountain of Youth, but it, you know, it is a Fountain of Youth, but there were many throughout the state, and it is not the exclusive Fountain of Youth.
It's the best marketing ever, right? Like, so there's a Fountain of Youth in St. Petersburg. People think that Wall Springs was a Fountain of Youth. I mean, it's anywhere there was a spring bigger than 3 feet across, they're like, oh, this must be Ponce de Leon's Fountain of Youth. I mean, it's a great story, but it's not true.
Well, but, and it is the perfect story for Florida. You know, people still come here seeking a new start for their life. You know, they find a little mobile home or something, a little patch of grass, and they start again. You know, they retire here, you know, Del Boca Vista from Seinfeld, you know, it's the Florida dream. So it's the perfect myth for Florida. It's branding, basically.
Do you know, we actually have a Del Boca Vista condo in Pinellas County?
No, really?
Yes.
Oh, I got to go there next time I'm over there and take pictures. That would be hilarious.
I will. Next time you're over, I will take you to it.
I love that outtake where what's his name who played George's dad is trying to say it. Have you ever seen that? And he can't spit out the words. It just makes me cry. It's so funny.
Yes, it's what is
Stiller and Mira?
Jerry Stiller.
Yeah, Jerry Stiller.
All right,
so we need to put a link to that clip on our show notes. All right, what's your next myth?
Okay, my next one. This one is a little concerning to people. How many original colonies did we have, Rick? How many in Florida? I mean, how many in the United States did we have?
Well, that depends. You know, that depends. You know, historically there's 13, but there was also East Florida and West Florida. They were not somehow official as the 13 that left Britain at the time, and they stayed loyalists. Is that what you refer to, East and West Florida, that were?
Yes. And we forget about the Canadian, what is Canada Day, but yes. So I love this story because Florida became a British colony in 1763 with the Treaty of Paris. It was under Spanish control until Spain lost a war. And it was basically, if memory serves, it's like, hey, if you want to keep Cuba, you got to give Florida to the Brits. They're like, all right. And then they were huge. Florida went to Louisiana. Florida went to the Mississippi River. West Florida, the British got control of Florida. And they're like, well, this is big and it's going to be a problem. So we got to split it in half. They weren't wrong. If we want to effectively govern, we're going to have West Florida from the Apalachicola River to the Mississippi River. And then from the Apalachicola East to the Atlantic, we're going to have East Florida. And that was the 14th and 15th colonies. They were just as much of a colony as anything else. They were the same, like Georgia, Massachusetts. I know everybody from Boston is going to get freaked out when I say this, you know, Delaware. I mean, they were all colonies, but the difference came is when the people in the 13 colonies north of the two Florida colonies started talking about a revolution. East and West Florida and the Canadian provinces were like, oh, hell no, we're not doing this. This is a really bad idea. We like the king. We're going to stay here. And they refused to sign the Declaration of Independence. And then what happens is all the Tories, all the supporters in the other colonies either get out of Dodge and go to Canada or come to Florida. We were just a bunch. We were a stronghold. And we've basically been punished for that ever since. Florida's never been on a winning side of a war. it's awful, right? Like, we were the third state to secede in the Civil War. And you know, we were wrong side. And then, of course, at the end of the Revolutionary War, which in the eyes of a lot of Floridians was really just an insurrection, as the worst prize for loyalty ever, Treaty of Paris of 1783, they're like, oh, well, you're going to go to Spain. Got like all these British people going, what the hell, man? Like, you just want to be left in peace to pillage. It was people. It's hard when you talk to people. You're like, well, there weren't 13 original colonies. There were actually quite a few more. And there's actually a very small book. I think it's a children's book, but I bought it at the Lincolnville Museum in St. Augustine that talks about the 14th state or the 14th colony. So, that's my Florida fallacy. Do you have another one?
Yes.
I mean, I know there's a lot, but I didn't know.
Yes. I want to talk about the term Florida cracker because, you know, it's interesting because cracker to some people is kind of a put down, but Florida cracker is a lot of people from Florida take that as a term of pride and that they tend to believe the story that was the sound of the whip of the Florida cowman, you know, going through town, crack the whip. But I think that is a fallacy. There is no definite answer as to where that term came from, but people were called crackers back in Shakespeare's time. There is in one of the plays that Shakespeare wrote a line that says, what cracker is this that deafs our ears with this abundance of superfluous breath? So it kind of meant a blowhard back in those times. And it was, again, not a term of endearment. Then there's another theory that the term cracker comes from the Spanish term, which I cannot say correctly, cuquero, I believe, which is their word for Quaker. And that, again, was not a positive term by the Spanish. And then there's a fourth one, in addition to the cracking of the whips and those other two, is that some people believe it came from cracking corn, you know, Jimmy crack corn and I don't care and all that kind of stuff. But people tend to really believe that it was the cracking of the whips. And I love that because they know a little bit of history. You know, they know about the cracker cowmen who, you know, went up and down the peninsula and they've read A Land Remembered and all that kind of stuff. But they are really, you know, believing that is it and there are no other options. And it you know, I think it's like you said, we want to know certain things. We don't want ambiguity. And once we are forced to question that, I mean, honestly, I felt a little challenged by what you said about the Seminole, and it, you know, it's like, wait a minute, I had these beliefs and I really want to hold on to them. You know, it's hard to kind of step away and, you know, look at a different way of a different story.
Well, and I got to tell you, sitting down in the Everglades with this wonderful British guy who I describe as like part Hugh Grant, part Indiana Jones in my mind. Like, I don't think he would agree with that assessment. And just having, you know, all these years of history that I knew come shattering around you was just like, I felt like an idiot. It's like, what's the line from Men in Black where Tommy Lee Jones says, well, she knows this and you know that. And 10 minutes ago, you knew there was no such thing as aliens. And Will Smith's like, all right.
I know the guy you're talking about. I've seen him speak. I think it was at a Florida Trust for Historic Preservation. He was one of the presenters, and he was very good. And I would, you know, I just want to learn more now. I mean, that's the good thing is it's exciting history, and it kind of brings it to life. I think that's one of the positives of this is that, you know, if you have this belief system that's settled and you pigeonhole all this knowledge in nice little cubbies, it's kind of static. But once you're challenged a little bit, it forces you to want to learn more, I think.
It does. Well, for me, I don't trust anything I've learned now. And yeah. Keep in mind, I have a master's degree in Florida studies. And we had one small book we read as one very large seminar about the Seminole Tribe of Florida. And it is, unfortunately, when I asked about this particular book, and I'm not gonna name it, I asked them, because I was there and I met Paul, and then I met Dave, who at the time was the archaeologist. I believe he's the head of their historical resources now. And I said, well, what books would you recommend? And they're like, well, they recommended one, and I'm not gonna name the name of it because they said, this one's very good, but it's very boring, but it's accurate. And I said, well, I read this book. And they said, oh, that author tries very hard. And I'm like, oh my God, please never say that about anything I've written.
It's like that's like bless her heart or his heart or whoever. So, bless their heart.
No, there is bless their heart. They try. And that's special. But then there is one book that the Seminole Tribe did with University Press of Florida, and it's basically a collection of interviews of oral histories and different aspects. It's not a full history, but it's called We Come for Good. And it is a really interesting read, and it's what's nice about it is it's a lot, but each of the chapters is a different interview with somebody, and it's a very interesting way to look at the tribe because you're seeing it through the eyes of people who are not white, and it's you're right. We're very bad with nuance. We it's the reason that as a country we have diabetes, right? Because we can't just have a little sugar. So we either go keto and don't eat carbs ever again, or we're type 2 diabetic taking our Ozempic all the time.
Do you think that's an American thing, or that's just human nature? Because I don't know.
I don't know either, but I got to tell you, it certainly seems to be the most pronounced in America. But yeah. I don't have a rosy view of America right now. So maybe don't ask me. I am not impressed by my fellow Americans lately. Individually, yes. As a whole, no. Like, again, another quote from Men in Black, where Tommy Lee Jones, Will Smith's character, is saying to Tommy Lee Jones, why can't we just tell people that people are smart, they would understand? And Tommy Lee Jones says, no, people are stupid. Individuals are smart. People are, he basically calls them like dumb cattle or something. And I don't think I can disagree with that as much as I would like to. I was very impressed. I want to give a shout out while we're here. April 15th, listeners, Rick and I are going to be selling our books and hyping up Florida at the Floridania show in Gulfport. So if you're listening well in advance, make plans to come out and see us and say hello. We'll have some spiffy magnets for our listeners with the cool old design that Rick did for us. Thank you for that, Rick. It's beautiful.
Oh, you're welcome. And both of us will have our books. So I have Finding the Fountain of Youth, and I will have Florida's Healing Waters. And we did it. Did you do it last time, or were you just there?
I just went to buy stuff. It's probably going to be better for my pocketbook to be actually not able to get up and walk around. But there's some great finds. I found a beautiful old hand-colored postcard from Barnhill, who is a very well-known in Florida. I always have to caveat that when I'm like, oh, this is a popular story to tell with in Florida circle. Because nobody probably from Michigan knows who Barnhill is, but God, it was beautiful. And I found there's just finds. I will be accepting credit cards, but a lot of people won't be. So bring cash, because if you like Florida, if you like this podcast and you go, you're going to want to buy things because it's super cool.
Yeah. Last time I sold books, and then at the very end, kind of after the show was over, I went out and shopped and I got this incredible tiki shirt that was vintage, probably from the 70s. I got a Seminole doll and a postcard for a project that I want to write about someday. So it's the cream of the crop. It's really good Florida ephemera. It's a lot of fun. Golf port's great.
Fantastic. And I'm looking forward to, seeing you. I don't get to see you that much, so it'll be nice.
Yeah. And you know, maybe what we should do is, before that date, do a talk about Gulfport so that people can really get the full Gulfport experience while they're there. It's so much fun.
That sounds like a great idea, but not next week. Next week, we have somebody coming to talk about the water in Florida and how you can have fun on the water. And I'm excited about that too.
Yeah, me too. And Ocala, do you think we should do a talk about Ocala? Are you finding fun things there?
I have been inside a building all day. And it's wonderful. Ocala, I can talk about Ocala, but I can't talk about any places to go that aren't outdoorsy. So I would need to come back and do more research. But well, yeah, we should definitely do an Ocala.
I can cover some of that stuff. I love Ocala. It's, it's a great place for me. So we'll do an Ocala talk too in the future. They are doing this summer. I think they're doing the Florida Trust for Historic Preservation is doing their conference in Ocala. So
really?
Yeah. So I think they're doing it with another group. Last time they did it with the Main Street group. I'm not sure if that's who they're having their conference with this year, but there was talk about doing some tours and looking at some of the vestiges, which is my favorite word, if you haven't noticed, of the roadside bit of Florida, because the Dixie Highway used to go through there and there was all sorts of fun roadside attraction stuff in addition to Silver Springs in Ocala. So.
Fair. Sounds good.
Yeah, so watch out for those big squirrels and the horses.
There was a huge squirrel as I walked in here, and I saw a beautiful black snake. I like Ocala can get as built up as it wants, but it still feels very wild to me.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
All right. But I do have to cut the podcast short so I can go get lunch in Ocala so we can talk about it in a future podcast.
Sounds great. Well, enjoy your lunch and have a good talk.
Oh, well, thanks for sharing your Ponce de Leon and cracker fallacies. I'm sure we'll come up with more in future episodes. And everybody else out there, thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.